This is HPR episode 2592 entitled, Tech Talk with Allison. It is hosted by Sigflup, and is about 50 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, this is a talk with Allison about Webites, Ruby, OS design, and other such things.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
My name is Sigflup, also known as Assembly, also known as Thea. With me today is Allison.
Hello.
And we're going to talk tech and other such things. It'll be a blast! Allison, so you, from rumor has it that you have a few web projects going on at the moment.
Well, the big thing that I'm working on right now is a little project called resourcecommunity.org, and this is something that's kind of close to home for me because, you know, I was recently kind of displaced, and I ended up in crisis houses and various places like that, and, you know, It was like, people were always telling me about these resources that are out in the community, and I was like, you know, this is sort of like privileged information, isn't it? Because this isn't really being broadcast to people who are out in the streets and stuff like that. And I was like, how do we get this information in front of people who are actually going to benefit from it?
Yeah.
And how do we, you know, keep track of what the needs are in the community and how they're being met? So my website is kind of along those general lines where, you know, the first priority is just like to let people list resources that are in communities so that people are aware of, you know, what's geographically close to where they are.
Yeah, so they keep it's peer-driven, is what you're saying.
Yeah, basically. You know, people can identify resources, then post them, and, you know, people can, you know, post about whether they had good experiences with these resources or bad experiences, because, you know, some resources are better than others. I mean, I've not actually been in one, but I've heard, like, a lot of bad things about homeless shelters and that kind of thing.
People
get their stuff stolen, or, you know, the...
That's what I hear, too.
Yeah, so, so I definitely, you know, want to, you know, get actual feedback from people, because I feel like, you know, there's this attitude like, well, we're providing them a place to live, you know, they should be happy just to have that, and I don't really buy into that. I mean, you know, if homeless shelters aren't accommodating to people, then people aren't going to want to stay there.
So do you envision most people getting this news, not this news, but get this resource through, like, libraries and stuff like that, or...?
Libraries or cell phones. I know that, you know, homeless people do have, cell phones now. So
I don't know if they have data on them, but they do have cell phones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I definitely want it to be, you know, a
thanks,
very
Obama. Sorry. All right.
Yeah. I want to make it a very, you know, user friendly type site. So if people are on their cell phones, they can use it easily. But it should also work well if they're just in the library or something like that. But, yeah.
This is a technical question. This is something, in my own web development, I've written some websites that are pretty much desktop only.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a user agent string. Do you infer whether the browser is mobile or not through that string? Like, because there can be so many strings, you know what I mean? Like, each device is unique. Is there like a, how do you, in other words, how do you know that your browser is mobile?
So that's a good question. It's done in the back end in my case. I do the detection on the back end through the website's built with Sinatra, which is a framework for Ruby development on the web, which sits on top of another kind of thing called Rack that interfaces with the web server and makes stuff happen.
Huh.
So, you know, I've got a basically function built into the code that just says, like, is the website mobile? Or is the web browser mobile? And if it is mobile, then we can include stuff in the page templates that we wouldn't if it was on the desktop. But it uses the user agent string. It's, I don't remember where I got the code from exactly, but it's kind of this complicated thing to...
And yeah,
it seems like it's pretty accurate in general. I'm not sure if
it's good that it's accurate. It's good that it's accurate.
Yeah.
So that leads us to the next interesting topic, the back end. You had mentioned Ruby.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of Ruby, and
Allison over here is a Ruby junkie.
I am a Ruby junkie. Yeah. The thing that I like, you know, about Ruby is it's such a cool, like, get it done language. You know, if you just need something to work and you don't want to spend like a huge amount of time on it, you know, Ruby's got libraries, you know, Ruby's got very, you know, user-friendly APIs that you can work with, and but also the design philosophy behind Ruby is very cool. It, you know, follows something that is called like the principle of least surprise, which basically means that you know, if you are familiar with the Ruby language and you know how it works, then if you try to do something that you've never done before, chances are it will work exactly the way you expected it to.
That's good. Yeah, that's. So, what do you use for your database typically?
So, I use CouchDB, and I went through like a lot of different NoSQL databases because I'm not a fan of SQL. I think that.
Yeah.
You know, it's time has kind of passed, and I think that...
You think it's time has passed?
I do. I think that is the general consensus, because there are security issues with SQL.
Okay, that makes sense.
There are things that, you know, SQL is kind of inefficient at doing that NoSQL databases...
There are, like, three things that I do in SQL, right?
Yeah.
And so, is it too complex? Is there too much to the SQL language, do you think? Too much functionality?
I think so. You know, I think it's become kind of bloated over time. I think it does more than it needs to, really. Like, the really neat thing about, you know, CouchDB is that it's got these things called views, and they're similar to queries, but they're actually written in JavaScript.
Right on. That's awesome.
And it's really easy to, like, do the same things that you would do with a query with these views.
It's kind of cool that you can potentially have your entire stack be JavaScript, aside from the HTML and CSS, but that's kind of cool. But anyway, so these views.
Yeah?
We were talking about views.
Yeah, I'm not going to, like, get into the technical details, mostly because I don't remember all of them, but you just construct a view based on some simple JavaScript code, and that will, you know, basically give you a list of elements or that you can kind of run through. You can get the first element or the last element, and basically based on the view that you construct. So,
okay, that's interesting. So, do you hold any, like, do you hold any, what's your license for the website? Is the back end available, or like, what do you think about copyright in general?
Good question. So, you know, I'm not, like, a huge fan of copyright, at least not the way that, you know, it's implemented today. I certainly, you know, think that, I mean, copyrights that go, like, what, the life of the author plus, like, 50 years.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
It's crazy.
It's, now, my position on this is I'm pretty sure that, I'm not sure, but, you know, I think this is a pretty reasonable explanation for why things are that way, is because, like, a lot of media companies are afraid that if the copyrights get short enough, then they're basically going to be competing with themselves.
Oh, okay, like, with their free stuff, they'd be competing with their free stuff.
Yeah, like, for example, if the copyright term is only, like, 10 years, well,
yeah,
10 years later, you know, they're going to have to be competing with all the stuff that's now free that they made 10 years ago.
Well, how do you feel about that being an incentive to make more and, like, make better and better things?
I mean, I think that's the kind of the way copyright was supposed to work. I think, you know, it's supposed to create incentives for people to create better and better things. And
copyright is a monetary incentive where you monopolize any work for a certain period of time.
Mm-hmm. But, Now, personally, like, I don't really, you know, have any interest on specifically holding a copyright for things that I've written. Like, basically, I'm a fan of Creative Commons and stuff like that. But, like, for me, when we're talking about my code, you know, it's usually, like, the MIT license or something like that. Basically, totally permissive, not restricted.
I'm most familiar with the BSD and the GNU license. What can you talk about the MIT license and what attracted you to it?
Well, I don't remember exactly what it says, but it's like pretty short. Basically, it just says like do whatever you want with this code as long as you retain this license. There are lots of licenses that are kind of similar to that and have like minor differences, but the MIT license isn't even the only one I've ever used, but
I've used the GNU and BSD in my day.
Yeah.
And public domain. I have a couple of public domain programs. Mm-hmm. So you do all this coding. Like, what was your favorite project to work on? Is there a favorite, or is there just so many that, like, you don't know?
Oh, God. Well, I've got, like, a lot of unfinished projects. You know, it's kind of been a thing for me where I
don't know if you can see this, audience, through Hacker Public, but I am raising my hand in agreement. I am also the queen of unfinished projects. But, okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's very easy to bite off more than you can chew when you decide to start a project because, you know, projects very easily, you know, grow in scope, you know.
Yes, yeah.
When you're playing them out, so
for me, my coding methodology is don't do hacks, right? Like code stuff as if you're going to code it for things in the future. If your application needs a GUI element to it, make a GUI that other applications can use. Like I found that's a lot easier for debugging and general maintenance of programs instead of the shortest distance from A to B. You have to have some structure there.
Yeah, definitely. The overarching structure of your application is something that you really do need to
pay attention
keep
to.
In mind. Yeah. And you know, the flip side of that, I mean, it's very hard to like work on a big project with like multiple people contributing to it and maintain that kind of structure. So
I've never done it. I've never maintained a project with tons of people, but the logistics of it is just crazy for me.
Oh yeah, I know. I don't think I've ever really done anything collaborative as a programmer before. I've always just made things and either I finish them or I don't. But I mean, there are a few things that you know, I've done that I thought were neat enough to justify like posting them online for other people to use. One of them that was kind of neat was a little thing that I wrote called Shimmy Sham, which was kind of a simple little tool that I made.
It has a ring to it, Shimmy Sham.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty simple. It's basically just like a script to generate project files for Visual Studio and like basic skeleton application for a DLL shim. So you could kind of if anybody like doesn't know what a DLL shim is, it's basically just a DLL that sits in between the application and the actual DLL that's kind of into access and gets in there and messes with stuff and does fun things. So,
I've often had to change the linker for Linux because of the lack of, like, I have this 32-bit application on a 64-bit system, and so I have to, you know, have a link to the 32-bit linker or run with the 32-bit linker rather. So. Is that kind of a bit like Shimmy Sham, or do you actively change how the library interacts, or do you provide more functionality, or you just completely replace calls with your own stuff?
You can do all of the above, really. I mean, you can add, you know, functionality, but it's hard to do that because you can't, like, change the interface, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yep.
The actual interface, you know, the function calls within the DLL have to still work and do the thing that the calling application expects them to do.
Yeah.
But, if you want to basically, the main thing that I actually used it for was, like, to interface with, like, the input library in Windows, like the X input library for controllers, and to to try and like make it more compatible, because I had like this controller and I wanted it to work on all my games, and I was like, there was actually this not to get too deeply into this subject, but like the controller.
No, we have the time. We have plenty of time. But okay.
Well, just like a rough overview, like the controller support on Windows is kind of a mess. They've got this thing called X input that a lot of things use, but there's also direct input, and I think they also have like controllers with raw input. So that's like three different ways you can interface with the controller.
Oh, okay.
A lot of games don't let you change the controls. So like if you have like a game you want to play and you don't only have one controller, and it's not like an Xbox controller or something like that, it can be a pain to actually get it to work sometimes. So, but Windows is kind of a jerk about like loading shim DLLs. Like, I didn't actually really address this problem, but there are some, you know, system DLLs that Windows like will refuse to load anything but the actual, you know, system DLL. And I think it's, you know, a pretty safe assumption that they did this for security reasons, but but you'd have to like resort to other techniques like DLL injection to actually get a shim DLL to work with those type of libraries. So
Sean motherfucking Webb, Latera Osel, he has done a lot of work on shims for libraries for ELFs and stuff like that. Research him; he's a pretty rad guy. So let's see here. Do you work on anything else that's interesting?
Let's see. I don't really have anything other than the resource community webpage that I'm working on right now. Like, the first project that I ever worked on, which is kind of interesting, was, like, the first big project I ever tried to code was an emulator for the Sega Dreamcast.
She's trying to kick out the emulators.
Oh, I don't know if this is coming across in the recording, but somebody's really kicking the bass outside.
Oh, yeah. You can't hear this. Maybe you can. There's a car out there, and the bass is insane. It's shaking our window.
My first project was to try and write a Dreamcast emulator, and I got as far as, you know, the processor emulation and stuff like that. I was trying to write it in
the SH2, right?
SH4.
SH4
is in the Dreamcast.
Dreamcast, okay.
Yeah, SH2 was in the Sega
Saturn. Saturn, yeah. I wouldn't touch that
with a 10-foot pole if I was trying to write an emulator. That is really super complicated.
Okay.
Sega Saturn was just like a monster of a console that, was the result of many questionable design decisions, but it's also really neat. Like, it actually kind of renders 3D objects using two-dimensional textures, like sprites, that have transformations applied to them. So it uses quads instead of polygons. But I just want to give a shout-out to Steve Kwok, who is...
Steve Kwok Mofos.
Yeah, who is currently working on a Sega Saturn emulator called Nova, which I support on Patreon.
Right on.
Really awesome of him to take on the Saturn, because, very few people have been up to that challenge. The only emulator that was, halfway decent for the Sega Saturn before that was called SSF. It was a pretty good emulator. It was only for Windows, unfortunately. I think the author's name was Shima, and he was from Japan. But he did a pretty good job with it. I mean, it runs most games pretty well.
So,
but,
I don't know much about the Saturn. Was it two SSH2s? SH2s? Or?
Yeah, I believe it was two, and then it had a video
splitter,
processor on top of that. And,
as do all consoles of that age.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but, my emulator was just for the Dreamcast, but, I didn't really
Did you have to, so the SH4 has memory management unit, which is good if you want to run BSD or whatever on the Dreamcast, but did you find that a lot of games use the memory management unit?
Well, to my knowledge, no. So Sega had their own development kit for the Dreamcast called the Katana.
Okay.
That was the library, I think.
Is it available? Can you find this library?
I think it's been leaked. I mean, it's out there.
Oh, sweet.
But, But there was also Windows CE for the Dreamcast.
Yeah, there was. Jesus Christ, I forgot about that, yeah.
And I do believe that Windows CE games did take advantage of the memory management. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure they did. Yeah. I don't think any other games that weren't Windows CE actually used the memory management, and I don't think there really were that many games that were developed on Windows CE for the Dreamcast. I think Sega's development kit was by far the most popular to write games on.
Oh, okay. So, cool beans.
But yeah, so I didn't really get like super far with the emulator, but it was a really good project for me because I learned like a lot about low-level programming assembly from that project, and I've like continued to use those skills. My big contribution to the Dreamcast scene was that I did an undub of the game Grandia 2, which you can still find out
there. You did an undub?
Undub. Basically, okay. The game was dubbed into English.
Oh, dubbed.
And,
okay.
Yeah, the Japanese voice acting was dubbed in English, and they took liberties with it. You know, the I wasn't like a huge fan of the English voice acting in that game, so I kind of took it upon myself to try and restore the original Japanese voices, but it was really hard because there were a lot of like technical hurdles. Like I had to edit files that were in like a proprietary compression format, and thankfully somebody else had written a tool to decompress and compress them. But and I had to do some reverse engineering to figure out, you know, how to modify certain parts of the script file without causing the, you know, game to crash and stuff like that. So it was challenging. I also retranslated the spoken parts from the original Japanese back into English to be more true to what the original Japanese said, because the English translations were not really, you know, they were sort of there, but you know, they were definitely not like literal direct translations.
All your baser belonged to us, for instance.
Yeah, not quite that bad, but definitely, you know, it's better to go back to the original Japanese and get back to what they actually said. And it flows a lot better, too. You know, I made sure that the script, because part of the what the game did was kind of the text would display as they were talking, and you wanted the timing to be synced up with the Japanese version, so I also had to restore the timings for the script from the Japanese version.
It's interesting.
And various other things like that. So it was quite a project. You know, a lot of undubs are basically just as simple as copying some files over, and then it's undubbed.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this was not the case for Grandia 2. It took a lot of work to make it happen, so...
Right on. Are you rocking the Linux or the BSD or the Haiku or anything like that? BOS?
Oh, God. I kind of wish that Haiku, you know, had a little bit more momentum as a project, because I really love the idea of somebody recreating BOS. I was kind of a fan of BOS back in the day, because... You know, it was, like, a really cool alternative Windows at the time. Like, it was, like, magic when you could have two programs playing audio at once back then. Yeah. That was, like, so amazing.
Yeah.
So,
That's cool. Haiku is, I don't know much about it, but it's very modular from what I understand.
Yeah.
A lot of threads in Haiku.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the technical ideas about it.
So, what you do know, however, is you're thinking about this new operating system. Could you tell us about it?
Well, like, originally, I had, like, an idea where I wanted to just create my own operating system from scratch, like so many people.
Oh, yeah. All geeks are like, this is, Unix stuff is pretty neat. I should write my own.
Yeah, yeah. Writing your own operating system, you know, it's such a neat idea, right?
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's something that realistically...
My brother-in-law is making a paper computer. He's done with that. Then he's going to write a compiler for it and then write an OS for it. Like, Jesus Christ, you're taking on way too much. You're never going to finish this. It's too much to do.
But, you know, my attitude has kind of shifted a little bit with this project. I realized that, you know, my original ideas weren't really practical in the sense that I didn't have the time to actually implement any of them. And
well, I may interject, Waz is the only person I know that like could work on multiple layers like that. But, okay, so...
So basically, I got to the point where I was like... you know, I'm just going to drop this entirely because it's not practical. And but recently, I've been kind of revisiting the idea because I thought, okay, so here's the problem that we're actually trying to solve by this project. You know, we're not trying to solve the problem of, oh, the operating system doesn't work at all. We have to re-implement everything. You know, it's so horrible. It's unredeemable. We can't do anything with it. I thought, no, that's not actually what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is just make things more modular, you know, make things so, rather than having applications be these monolithic things that you kind of compile as a whole, and they're like their own universe where everything that happens in the application stays in the application, you know?
Whatever happens in the application stays in the application. I like that. That's good. Yeah, I gotta use that.
that's kind of the design philosophy to, you know, applications right now.
Yeah.
And I feel like that idea is flawed because, you know,
very monolithic.
Very monolithic. And I think that, you know, modular design is a really powerful thing because, you know, you can reuse a lot of stuff. And, you know, I can't count the times when I thought, you know, it would be really nice if I had this functionality from this other program in my program. Yeah. But actually making that happen, I don't even know where to start, right?
Was this similar to HERD or microkernels or anything like that?
I honestly don't know enough about how HERD is actually implemented.
I don't know much about HERD either.
I think that, you know, the idea of a microkernel is definitely similar, but...
It sounds like you want a standard protocol for all units.
Well, yeah. So basically, and this is something that I really get from the design philosophy of Ruby, because, you know, one of the great things about Ruby is that, like, if you need a library to do something in Ruby, it probably exists, you know? Because, you know, people who solve problems in Ruby, they tend to do it in very, you know, modular, reusable ways.
Yeah.
Because that's just, like, part of the philosophy behind the language, right?
Yeah. And nice connection to the beginning of the interview there. That's good.
Not intentional, but okay.
It's good. It's good. Okay.
Yeah. So, basically, with the whole modularity thing, it's like, so we have, you know, these units of code, and we can reuse them, and that's all very nice. But again, Ruby is still its own universe. You know, what happens in the Ruby interpreter stays in the Ruby interpreter.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, really, we're all out here. We're all writing code. We're all trying to solve problems. We want to be able to help each other do that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not very efficient when we're all, like, creating these monolithic creations. Like, Unix is very much about the application, you know, the whole design philosophy is kind of built around that. It's like there's a tool for everything, right? That's kind of the Unix design philosophy. But the problem is that all these tools kind of work in their own different ways.
Yeah.
Like, it's can be tedious to learn how to make a tool do a certain thing. And if you actually want to mess with the functionality of a tool and get into its inner workings, you know, it can be quite a lot to take on.
You're going to have to. It sounds like you're going to have to. Figure out a homogeneous way to interact with other objects.
Well, so Ruby already does this pretty nicely, and that's you know, kind of the nice thing about, you know, the Ruby design philosophy is that you can pick out a lot of details of this, and you can say, this is very nice, but ultimately, you know, Ruby being its own thing, you know, it's hard to make use of this in the grander context because, you know, Ruby, first of all, I think the big thing that puts people off Ruby is that Ruby is slow.
Yep. And that's stuff. I hear that. Wow.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, Ruby is one of the slower languages. It's definitely...
Our computers are pretty fast, though. Like, we're not on the little 486s.
Even so, though, like, there are other concerns when you're using Ruby.
Does
like,
it take a lot of memory, by chance?
I don't know exactly what the memory footprint of the interpreter is. I think it's gotten better. I mean, it's not huge, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, but...
All right.
But, yeah, so... But there are other things to be taken into consideration here, too, like energy efficiency, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're all running this, like, super high-level stuff that is really distant from what the machine's actually doing, it's really energy inefficient to be doing that. So,
energy inefficient, yeah, I see what you're saying.
So, yeah, so basically what my thinking is here, that we need to, like, take some of the elements of the design philosophy of Ruby and bring them down to a lower level so that we can have applications at a low level that work more like Ruby applications, which I think could be a pretty powerful idea because, like, there are certain things about the way that Ruby does things that are very smart and that allow you to do some surprisingly powerful things. Like, Ruby's really big on the idea of passing data in messages.
Okay.
Like,
a lot of languages aren't very good at that.
Yeah.
You carry strings, right? Like, that's the interaction between units is a string.
Well, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a string. There are different ways that you can approach the whole message system, but the basic idea is that instead of having functions, you have messages, you have methods that have messages that communicate with each other via messages.
Yeah. So would you write like a unit of computation, not a function, but like a unit of computation as an input and an output, or?
Basically, I mean, like functions, everything has an input and an output.
Yeah. But your input is not a message. Well, you can have like an input that is a language, pretty much, right? And if you parse it in your unit of execution, then.
Well, like you in Ruby, you can like pass around like code like it was data because it's an interpreted language, so you can do some pretty powerful things like that. Like my website relies on templates that are written in Ruby. Templates are really a strong feature of interpreted languages because you can create these templates to render pages that allow you to kind of interface with the back end in a pretty seamless way. But so the important thing to keep in mind about the kind of message, processing, the advantages of it are that, basically when you're writing code like that uses messages, that means that you can send messages between memory spaces and it still makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's like a super important thing when you're talking about demodularizing an operating system.
How would you in this effort to make this operating system, would you have to make your own debugger, do you think? Or like, how would you sort of figure out what message goes when and where and what goes after that?
Well, so back to kind of the core of the subject. Okay, so as I was saying, I realized that it was impractical to kind of start from scratch and make this kind of an operating system.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, what actually can we do? And so I thought, well, Ruby, like, the interface that Ruby provides, is consistent between Ruby implementations, meaning that if you're using Ruby on like Linux or using it on Windows, it doesn't matter. The interface, all the core methods, the parts of Ruby that you use to actually interface with the operating system remain constant no matter what operating system you're interfacing with.
Okay.
And that is really the key to bringing kind of the Ruby design philosophy down to a lower level and actually having it make sense. So the idea is like to create, instead of a real operating system, a virtual operating system that actually sits on top of an operating system Windows.
Plan 9 did after Plan 9 there was Inferno, which is kind of an operating system on top of an operating system. I don't know if you've heard of Inferno.
I did look it up, I'm not sure, again, about all the technical details of how they implemented that. I don't think that they used the type of message passing that I'm talking about to get, like, the inter-process communication going. But
One thing that I would... This is kind of stepping on me a little bit. The one thing I'd like to do is have a lot of Raspberry Pis, and one connected to a screen, one connected to a keyboard, one connected to a hard drive, and write an OS such that you can transfer execution between computers, like Raspberry Pis.
Yeah.
And you figure out the latency of input and output, and you kind of move the program towards what is most latent, or away from what is most latent, rather. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. That's a thought. But, so everything is an object in your operating system.
Well, so I think that would actually be kind of an oversimplification, because, like, in Ruby, everything literally is an object. Like, I thought that,
Are you objectifying OSs? I don't know. It's a stupid joke.
It's kind of, it's sort of like on that line of thinking, though. I mean, because operating systems, Linux, is written in C. It's not object oriented at the core. I'm not sure, like, what language Windows the kernel is written in. I think it's a mix of C and assembly, or
yeah, probably.
And I think most operating systems are written in C. And yep. So they're not object-oriented from the ground up. And object-oriented programming is a really powerful tool if you want to reuse code and have it be very modular.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, getting oriented programming down to the OS level could have some pretty powerful implications. But when I'm talking about like passing messages, like when you were saying like passing stuff or, you know, rearranging how computational resources are being distributed across the network, the great thing about message passing is it's also network agnostic, meaning that you can actually, you know, use the same interface to communicate with a program locally as you do over a network. It doesn't matter.
It's pretty brutal. That's fucking metal. That's cool.
So, it's like I said, it's a really, you know, powerful idea.
You could just have separate computers. You could write this with like five computers, right? All networked together, and that would be fun. That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you can have like different parts of the operating system running on a different computer, and as long as the protocols are efficient enough and the network is fast enough, it just doesn't matter. I mean, that's so.
I asked you this before. I don't know if you'd answered or whatnot, but would you be interested in sort of the input stage having a syntax aware parser, right? The message protocol is a language of its own, kind of like PostScript, right? Like PostScript does a very simple thing. It prints a file. But it's an entire language, right? Like PostScript is a Turing complete language,
right?
And how do you feel about passing, like, essentially source code from object to object?
Well, so taking a step back, like if you look at the way that Ruby handles message passing, which is again really smart, you know, is that
what's smart about
well, there is a single method in every class called the send method in Ruby.
Oh.
And this is basically like the go-between between your class and the rest of the world. So the send method gets called every time you send something to an object in Ruby. I don't know, I'm not sure exactly how they implement it in the interpreter. I don't think they might actually call the send method if you don't define a custom one, or they call their own send method or that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
But, because Ruby has the send method that you can implement, you can actually control how messages are passed into your programs or into your objects. So you basically can handle messages any way you want.
Yeah.
And I'd like to keep that aspect of the design philosophy. I don't want to try and tell people that they have to use specific type of messages or a specific format for those messages.
Yeah.
I want them to be able to decide, you know, how they want to communicate with each other, you know?
Okay.
So I don't want to dictate that. You know, I want I want the communication to be very open. I want there to be different possibilities in terms of how things communicate with each other.
Yeah.
So that's basically what I'm thinking. So, and additionally, on the other side of this equation, though, it has to be fast enough, because people are going to care if things get significantly less efficient. Like, nobody's going to use this if they have to be sending messages and all the time they're like, this is too slow. I mean, it's decreasing our benchmarks by like 50%. This is unacceptable. You know, we can't port our programs to this. So the idea to get around that is that, you know, at the compiler level, you know, if we're going to call the object in this operating system nodes. So if nodes exist in the same memory space, then they actually can directly call functions or call methods like you do in traditional object-oriented programming with like C++ and stuff like that. So you, when you're in the same memory space, you're allowed to make direct calls.
Yeah.
And this is like really important because, you know, when you're talking about like efficiency, you know, we're going to have the ability to have nodes, you know, have different memory spaces, but they can also exist in the same memory space. And when they exist in the same memory space, then things get a lot more efficient.
So, okay, so remote procedure calls, right? Like that NFS is based on in Samba mm-hmm. and a lot of stuff. How do you feel about RPC? Is RPC aware that, I've never used it, right? Is it aware that it's on both points are on a machine and makes like a Unix socket or something like that instead of a network socket?
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't actually know much about the implementation of RPC.
No, either do I. It's I think it's kind of looked over. It's something that I'd like to research a little bit. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, and I think if I actually do get, you know, deep into the whole development of this project, then I definitely am going to have to look at RPC, because really, you know, since this is a virtual operating system, you have to build the implementation on top of other operating systems.
Yeah.
So RPC is, I'm going to have to use whatever the operating systems provide for inter-process communication. Then I'm going to have to kind of build on top of that a universal interface.
Yeah.
So RPC is probably something that would actually be used in an implementation.
Right, down with RPC. Yeah, you know me. Sorry.
Yeah, so I want to get to the point where, you know, the virtual operating system is running on top of the operating system, and it's basically like you can write applications for the virtual operating system, and this will be invisible to a user.
Yeah,
like they will be using an application written for this virtual operating system, and it'll load up just like any other operating system. There'll probably be like a daemon or a service in the background that actually controls what the low-level stuff of what the operating system is, or the virtual operating system is doing, communicating with the real operating system, so you can make things efficient, because you don't want to have to load up the virtual operating system for every single program. You know, that's
oh, yeah, that would be ridiculous.
The problem of efficiency, but
so that's a problem with interpretive languages versus compiled languages, is you're loading up an interpreter for every program. But
so I can envision like a service or daemon that basically communicates via virtual operating system, processes via RPC or something similar to that, being actual implementation. So
cool. There's an interesting what is it? The debugging framework for Unix. What's the name of the? There's a suite of function calls to set breakpoints in memory and do like debuggy things. And what I'm getting at is how would a process look as an object? Would it be just like text in a heap and stack, or like how would you? I don't know. It's not a very good question, I don't think. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I mean, so internally, again, you've got to deal with, you know, how existing operating systems work. So the answer to that is that a process that's using this virtual operating system is not really going to, look that much different to the, you know, real operating system than any other program.
Yeah.
It's going to still, you know, be packaged in basically the same format and the same type of expectations, or possibly like there'll be like an EXE wrapper that will be standard, and then that will load the code from the actual modules of the operating system. That's another possibility. But the modules for the operating system, probably, if like the EXE wrapper approach would allow you to have like the modules like structured in their own different way, that would make more sense to the virtual operating system. So I can't say for sure like what that would look like in practice, because I haven't researched that particular subject deeply enough.
So the advantage of having a virtual operating system is you're leveraging the work that has already been done on accessing files and data from a hard drive, displaying things.
Drivers are what you need.
So you're looking, how do you feel about using just the Linux kernel and writing on top of that?
I'm not super familiar with the Linux kernel at a low level, so it would be challenging. Definitely doable, though. I mean, you could use the Linux kernel as a basis, and then you could have this virtual operating system on top of it, and that would be like how you'd get like maybe the closest you'd have to like a real implementation where you're just running the virtual operating system.
Would you support like different? This is if you have Windows, you run this. This is if you have Solaris, you run this. Mm-hmm. Like, would you, how do you feel about that, sort of maintaining that? Or are you sort of geared, you mentioned Xe's, are you going to do this with Windows?
Yeah, well, Windows is what the majority of my work has been on in the past. I use
That's all right, Windows is completely fine.
Yeah.
I use Bing Ming W for my Windows development.
These days I'm, you know, developing on Ubuntu, which is kind of nice. I've got a neat little laptop that I use just for coding. Which is
it's very cute. And you're not aware of this, but we have this table here, and my laptop is on the right, and her laptop is on the left. And yeah, it's very nice. But the go ahead.
Yeah. So I have nothing against Linux. I just I used to like running a lot of games, and it was difficult to get games to run in Linux. So to me, it just like was more efficient just to run everything on Windows. But and also I had kind of like a bad experience with Linux the first time I tried it. Like it was a while ago, and I had like lots of troubles with things breaking, and kind of soured me on the whole Linux as a everyday operating system thing. But these days I think it's, you know, very usable. And
It's very usable these days. Back when I used Linux, like, you'd have an Orinoco card, this beautiful wireless card, and you had to patch the kernel with PCMCA support and just stuff like that. It was miserable. Now you can, that's the thing I like about Unix and BSDs and Linux and stuff like that, is you can swap the hard drive out, right, of one computer to another, and have it run with very little hiccups. Maybe the network interfaces are named differently, but that's about it. Like,
I remember like wireless support on laptops was a huge thing on Linux.
Some laptops are a battlefield, right? Like,
yeah. But, you know, the great thing is that a lot of these problems are solved now. You know, the Linux developers have found solutions to them. The Linux kernel is very robust. You know, it works on most hardware that you want to run it on without really doing anything special. So it's made a lot of progress in the past decade.
Yeah, totally has made a lot of progress.
So, and again, like I said, there's no point in throwing out all that work. I mean,
no, not at all.
And it's not practical, and it doesn't really help anybody to throw out all that work.
Yeah.
But you still want to, you know, live in a world where if I write a program on one operating system, it will work the same way on another operating system. And unfortunately, that's just not the world we live in today. So, but I think it's doable, you know, because ultimately, while operating systems may, you know, implement what they do in different ways, ultimately, they're all trying to do the same thing. I mean, they're all trying to make stuff appear on the screen, or, you know, fetch input from the keyboard and, you know, figure out what the user's typing, or, you know, communicate with, you know, external devices, that kind of stuff. And all this stuff is basically universal. I mean, there's no reason why you can't have a common interface to all these different things an operating system does.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, it's really makes a lot of sense, because, again, nobody wants to have to, you know, write separate code just for a different operating system, you know?
Yeah. As far as, like, not writing a kernel again, one thing that I do to learn is I write things that have already been written.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, pthreads. Pthreads is pretty awesome. Let's see if I can write my own, you know, threads kernel and stuff like that. But it's to learn. It's not for producing things.
And I think that, you know, coding to learn is a very important thing, because, you know, like I was saying with my Dreamcast, I never finished it, but I learned so much by doing it. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
It's
the best way to learn about something when it comes to computers, is try to fucking program for it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of making a virtual operating system, right, if I didn't have the background and, like, understanding, you know, how computer processor works, work at a low level and stuff like that, or the background in, like, Ruby and experience with super high-level languages as well, then I would have no idea how to bring these two concepts together. I mean, it just, you know, I would never be able to get there if I didn't have the background, so.
Okay. Well, you know, I think it's been, like, 47-ish minutes.
Yeah.
I think we're gonna... Time flew. Time flew quickly.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, exactly. And so we're gonna call it a day. How about that?
I think that would be good. Yeah, I think
thank
we
you.
Covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, I think we did too. Thank you for talking with us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
Yeah, and to check out one word. What's one word that expresses things right now?
Awesome.
Awesome. All right, awesome. Things are awesome. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.